The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Well, David, as promised, sometimes we need to go back and listen to some of the best of shows. And I know you're going to be talking to Richard Duncan over the next couple of weeks. Now, the last time we talked to Richard Duncan a couple of months ago, he was talking about the New Depression. And he's got a book about it. And you're going to continue that commentary in a few weeks when you meet him in Denver.
What we're doing today is, again, a look back at our conversation with Richard Duncan, with Russell Napier, with John Taylor, and with Michael Pettis. And I chose these four from last year as really some of the guiding lights as we head into 2013 and 2014, defining some of the major themes, both in terms of globalization, the dollar, debt markets, current interest rate trends, and we get some policy insights from John Taylor on that. And that, I think, is going to be very helpful as we try to frame what 2013 and 2014 hold for us as investors, as individuals. The insights that we gained last year, frankly, they need to be reviewed. And then, of course, as you mentioned, we will be having a second conversation with Richard Duncan here in the next couple of weeks, as well as with Michael Pettis here in another couple of weeks as well. For those of you who didn't listen to last year's interview with Richard Duncan and Michael Pettis, this is just to give you an idea of the framework that they're coming from and some of the ideas that they've been thinking about prior to this year's exploration and the most recent conversations we'll be publishing here in weeks to come.
Well, and let's go to that recording right now. Now, for the sake of the listener and for the sake of time, we're not going to comment a lot between the clips. And so we'll be listening to the Richard Duncan clips without interruption until the end.
Here are the highlights from Richard Duncan. As he notes in the New Depression, the breakdown of paper money, there's a number of things that have changed over the last 100 years. One, we've moved from a gold currency standard, which we know, to a fiat currency standard. But more subtly, there's been a shift away from just simply fiat money to a massive expansion of credit instruments. And in fact, he argues in the book that we've moved to a situation that is hyperinflationary in terms of our credit expansion. The only thing that masks that hyperinflation is one key component, globalization, and a tremendous drop in labor rates.
The big change, I think, happened in 1968 when the U.S. changed its laws and no longer required the Federal Reserve to back dollars with any gold whatsoever. At that point, the nature of money changed. Up until then, we had been on a commodity-backed monetary system. In other words, gold backed up our money. Afterwards, we moved to a pure fiat monetary system or pure paper money system. And afterwards, the nature of money changed. Before, if you took a dollar bill to the Treasury Department, at least in theory, they were meant to give you some gold in exchange for that. Now, if you take a dollar bill to the Treasury, they will just give you another dollar bill. So what's the difference between a dollar bill now and a 10-year Treasury bond? They're essentially both credit instruments. In the past, there was a clear difference between money, which was gold, and credit. Now that the difference is blurred, or perhaps there is no longer any difference, money is credit. And so the nature of money changed. That really changed. That was the beginning of the big change in our economic system. Yes, of course, when Nixon in 1971 in August ended the Bretton Woods system by refusing any longer to allow other countries to exchange their dollars into U.S. gold. But before that, President Johnson in 1968 had asked Congress to remove the requirement that the Fed maintain its gold backing for dollars. Up until that time, the Fed was required to keep 25% gold backing for each dollar. And Johnson made a speech to Congress, and he said, we don't need to keep gold to tell us what our money is worth. We've moved beyond that. But oh, how wrong he was. Once we broke this link between dollars and gold, everything began to change. And the most important thing that changed is credit absolutely exploded. Total debt or total credit, debt and credit are really two sides of the same coin. Total debt in the United States, and by that I mean government debt, household sector debt, corporate debt, and financial sector debt, all debt, first went through $1 trillion in 1964. Over the following 43 years, total debt expanded 50 times to $50 trillion. So from $1 trillion to $50 trillion in less than 50 years. This explosion of debt completely created the world we live in. our world was made out of that credit. We have all been much more prosperous than we would have been had we remained on a gold standard. This ushered in the age of globalization. It allowed Asia to pursue its very successful strategy of export-led growth and transform China from a very third-world country into the China we know today. So this explosion of credit completely changed our world. And I would really suggest that it created a different kind of economic system, which I'll discuss a little later, I hope. But the thing is that in 2008, we hit the limit, it seems, for credit to expand any further, at least on the private sector side, because in 2008, the private sector effectively went bankrupt and couldn't repay its old debt and was cut off from any additional debt. And it was at that point that New Depression, as I call it, began.
The New Depression, we're approaching the period, or arguably we're in it today. You're assuming that credit expansion is the hallmark of growth in a credit-dependent economy, and therefore if credit is contracting, that naturally the economy is getting off the rails. You've just suggested that your private sector credit expansion ended in 2008, but perhaps there's something else that can fill the gap. My one concern would be, and maybe this harkens back to even just the title of your book, The Corruption of Capitalism, how do you avoid public sector debt expansion and having that be legitimate in terms of going towards real needs and growth-oriented projects as opposed to sort of the crony capitalism that we've seen where perhaps the debt expansion, the credit expansion, is just to the friends, quote-unquote, of those in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, well, very good question. In Chapter 9 of the book, the New Depression, I describe how our system evolved from laissez-faire capitalism into this new system, which I call creditism, for lack of a better word. And I think the starting point for everyone in the United States, what we all really need to understand is that our economic system hasn't been capitalism for decades. Laissez-faire capitalism died in World War I, when Europe went off the gold standard and when all the European nations, the governments took over their economies to fight the war, followed by the U.S. jumping in and taking over the U.S. economy to fight World War I. And then not that long after, the U.S. government took over complete control of the economy again during World War II, controlling all aspects of production, prices, and distribution to fight the war. And effectively, the government's been spending between 20 and 25% of GDP every year since World War II. So we haven't had capitalism for now coming up for a century. And that's the starting point. We don't have capitalism. To move to something else where we're discussing a better way for the government to spend money, this isn't abandoning the economic system we have now. It's adapting the economic system that we have now to make it work better. The economic system we have now is creditism. Let me explain. Capitalism, the growth dynamic under capitalism, it was driven by the private sector. Businessmen would invest, and some of them would make a profit. They would save that profit, or in other words, accumulate capital, hence capitalism, and they would repeat the process, investment, savings, capital accumulation, investment, savings. And that was the growth dynamic. It was very difficult, and it took a lot of hard work. Well, that's not the way our system has worked now for decades. The growth dynamic in our economic system has been driven by credit creation and consumption, and more credit creation and more consumption. And that's worked miracles. That's created very rapid economic growth now for 4 or 5 decades. The problem is this new economic system seems that it's hit the full extent of its potential to create any more growth and actually could quite possibly now collapse into a very protracted depression because the private sector can't bear any more debt. And that means only the government sector can bear any more debt. And so the real issue is, how is the government going to spend the debt that it's going to accumulate to keep the economy from collapsing into a depression? These have been very aggressive moves of paper money creation, much more aggressive even than Japan. But as a result of those moves of paper money creation and buying government bonds, in the case of the Fed, this has driven down interest rates even further. And the reason they've been able to get away with this, one of the main reasons that this hasn't already led to very high rates of inflation, is because of globalization. Globalization is putting extreme downward pressure on wages globally. In fact, this resulted in a 95% drop in the marginal cost of labor. Before, if you wanted to hire an industrial worker to build an automobile, you had to pay someone in Michigan $200 a day. Now you can pay someone in India $5 a day. And so this collapse in wage rates is creating extreme disinflationary or deflationary pressures that has enabled the central banks to get away with massive paper money creation without creating high rates of inflation. Now, they won't be able to continue doing this forever, running trillion-dollar budget deficits and financing with paper money, but they should be able to do this without too much more difficulty for another 5 years, perhaps even 10 years. The problem is 10 years from now, the U.S. government is going to be just as bankrupt as Greece. And at that point, then, very, very bad things will begin to happen. So it's crucial to change the way the government spends money between now and then and actually have the government spend money in a sensible way through investing that restructures the economy and generates new technologies that restructures the U.S. economy and eliminates the global imbalances that have led to this crisis and actually prevents us from collapsing into a new severe Great Depression 10 years from now.
Well, David, Richard Duncan made the point that the United States is going to be more broke than Greece, or actually on paper we are right now. Now, another guest that we've had that we'd love to go back and listen to is a regular guest, Russell Napier.
Well, that's right, Kevin. Russell is on the program with some regularity because he has a lot to say, a lot to offer. Let's cut right to it. We start with an explanation of what's happening in China, the rebalancing there, and then move on to general overvaluation in both the stock and bond markets here in the U.S. This was the early part of last year when prices were actually quite a bit lower than at the end of the year, meaning that overvaluation started at levels that were unhealthy at the beginning of the year and only got worse as the year progressed. Maybe we could start with China as perhaps the big thing that is not getting as much attention this year. Europe's still in the headlines, but China, you believe, will be even more so as the year goes on?
Yes, that's correct. The good thing about China is it's becoming less competitive. That's good for a lot of people working in the U.S. and the United Kingdom and job creation. It's the rebalancing of global growth, which we've always been told is a good thing, and clearly that part of it is a very good thing. And I think you can see on the ground that coming to fruition. But there's a flaw, I think a crucial flaw in this rebalancing, which is the surpluses which China has been amassing for many years have found a way into the hands of the People's Bank of China. And they have concentrated virtually all of them in foreign government securities, primarily treasuries, but other foreign government securities as well. And as we rebalance global growth, the People's Bank of China simply finds itself accumulating fewer dollars and therefore has less to invest in these security markets, these particular security markets. Now, that rebalancing is good primarily for developed world corporations. So a very clear example would be Apple Corporation. Now, ultimately, Apple Corporation isn't going to have the vast bulk of its accumulated cash in the treasury market. So as we rebalance global growth, we're moving the allocation of the surplus savings in the world out of the hands of central bankers who choose government debt over every other asset. And we're moving it more into private hands like Apple or other developed world corporations, or increasingly private hands in the form of individual Chinese who are moving their capital out of China. And they simply are not allocating the great vast majority of it to the treasury market or the Eurobond market. So the burden of funding these governments, developed world governments, will increasingly fall upon the people and of those countries. And it begs the obvious question, are there sufficient savings in these countries to fund both the government and the private sector? I question whether there is. And I think this private sector deleveraging we've been witnessing for some years now, that could have a considerably further way to go unless somebody else turns up to fund the government. I think if we want to look to the future, then perhaps the government of Italy is a poster child for what happens when the going gets tough. Italy was cruising along with relatively low financing costs up until the summer of last year. But then very suddenly over the summer, that all changed and 10-year bond yields went above 5% and then suddenly briefly above 7%. And Italy was transformed. It lost its democratically elected government. It got a government of technocrats. It began to aggressively try to implement existing taxation laws and bring in new taxation laws, act on spending, act on pension age, act on all the things that make Italians different from Germans. It was almost as if overnight the move in the bond yield from 3% to 7% transformed Italy from a land of Italians to a land of Germans or a land of aspiring Germans. Now, the jury is out as to whether that can be achieved or not, but I think for all the rest of us, it gives us some idea of just how far the goalposts have to be moved in a period when the bond yield would go, say, from 2 to 3% into the 5 to 6% range. Now, I think, and I think history tells us this very clearly, that when we get to that stage, then the government will force people, will be in the business of forcing people to buy government debt. Now, you might say it's impossible, it can't be done, but it's been done historically. A classic way this was done in the United States after World War II was through Regulation Q, with a government-mandated a deposit rate. The banks were not allowed to set their own deposit rates. The government did that. Now, the government constantly mandates a deposit rate well below inflation. It becomes relatively easy for the government to sell T-bills below the rate of inflation. And if we manage a reasonably high level of nominal GDP growth, significantly above nominal bond yields, then over a prolonged period of time, and I mean decades, then the government can grow its way out. So this manipulation of the yield on government debt is the answer for the government. And socially, it is so much more acceptable than the alternatives. Whatever you think of the history of hyperinflation, austerity, default, and deflation, they are socially incredibly disruptive, incredibly socially dangerous. And many of those market-driven events have led to warfare or massive domestic social unrest. So I think in the grand scheme of things, when a government sits down and decides which avenue to pursue, this avenue of repression, which is a form of theft of savings, there is no better word for it, that form of theft of savings will always be more socially acceptable than the market-driven events of austerity, hyperinflation, deflation, devaluation. So the catalyst is the bond yield. At a certain level of bond yields, as Italy has shown us, these are the things that have to be done by the government, and I think these are the things that will be done by the government.
Do you force the model just by continuing the conversation? You know, say the world central bankers continue to repeat over and over again that we have concerns about deflation, and thus you see more of a trickle of investment dollars flowing into the bond market, willingly participating in a negative real rate of return environment, but feeling like that the credit risk is warranted given a quote-unquote deflationary environment, even if that quote-unquote deflationary environment is just a figment of the government's imagination. I'm just wondering how you force the model of negative real rates of return and have people voluntarily take that on. The Summers-Barsky thesis, Larry Summers wrote many decades ago, implied that the math behind that certainly forces people in the direction of gold. Negative to low real rates of return, people simply opt out. Is there a way of keeping people from opting out?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think it strikes at the very core of how a financial repression works. The scale of restrictions you need to implement financial repression to force people into government debt are really huge, and they're not of a scale that this generation of investors has come across before. And the one that would rise to the top of the list would be capital controls, exchange controls, restrictions on the free movement of capital. If I'm in the business of trying to make my insurance companies or banks fund the government almost regardless of the yield relative to inflation, I may have to stop them doing other things. It's not just a matter of saying you have to do this. I may have to try and stop them doing other things. Now, in the period from 1945 to 1972, obviously the gold price was pegged anyway, at least in dollar terms it was pegged. So you couldn't actually make any money in gold. All your gold payment came at the end. Gold is much more a flexible item now. But if we could concoct a world in the past where the gold price wasn't moving freely, we can concoct a world in the future where the gold market isn't moving freely. So when I think of financial repression and what it means, for many people it may be rather arcane. For people who don't have any savings, they may say, well, surely this is the best way to do it. But for me, the problem is the issue of civil liberties and civil rights and freedom in a world where the government needs money. And when you begin to get your hands deeper and deeper into the hands of the people, pockets of the people, then I think many, many very serious questions have to be raised. For those of you who know the history of the hearth tax, which we used to have in the United Kingdom, there was a tax depending on how many hearths you had to light your fire. This proved to be not really a tax that could be implemented because it involved going inside a property to assess the level of taxation, and that was deemed to be an infringement on rights. However, it was replaced with a window tax, and as windows can be counted from the outside, then the taxation system moved forward. So repression is a very big issue and takes us well beyond just the issue of making life insurance companies buy more government debt into capital controls and other restrictions. That's the history of it. It comes with a whole bundle of restrictions. It's not just this one targeted item. It's a very different world. It's a world of government control, less markets. But when governments are desperate to be funded, governments will be funded. And I think this is the rubber meets the ground in terms of what has to change.
Well, David, that is the sad fact. Governments don't produce anything, but they definitely get funded if they need the funding. Now, you know, no economics student out there doesn't know the name John Taylor. The Taylor rule is something that comes up with a fair and orderly way of adjusting interest rates if you're a central bank.
Now, interestingly, the interview with Russell Napier, we actually talked about repression of interest rates below a natural level in order to fund government. As Napier said, government will be funded. So we go to the Taylor interview with that in mind, knowing that there is a normal rate that rates should be set at. And if it is below that rate, you're not really following the Taylor rule. You're breaking the rules towards some other end. John is a policymaker, an economist. He's served several different presidential administrations. And here's just a brief sampling from our conversation with John this last year.
It's not an exaggeration to say that spending is a major source of the problem now. And I think it's very important to get that spending growth under control. It's not really even cutting spending. It's just preventing it from rising so rapidly, which is what's happening now and is projected to rise in the future. So in my view, we should not be raising taxes or making the economy slow down on the basis of higher tax rates. But what we should be doing is looking for tax reform, making the tax system more efficient to encourage economic growth, and also at the same time removing the unnecessary programs that have expanded so rapidly very recently.
If you had the ear of the next president, whoever it may be, and you have had the ear of past presidents, if there was a singular bit of advice, what would you start the conversation with?
The principles that I outline in my book would be a preamble. There's no question about it, because there makes so much sense. We need, policy's been unpredictable, the rule of law's been deviated from, we need to fix those two things. We've got to have more emphasis on the market system and incentives and limiting the role of government. But then the deal is, how do you apply those? Those are abstract, if you like, more academic. They're extraordinarily important, but how do you apply those principles? And I would start with the budget. We have a gigantic budget gap. We have a deficit that it's getting larger. The debt is exploding. And so take that into account. I have a plan to do that, which is not draconian. It's not austerity. It's just common sense. And I would go to monetary policy. You mentioned the dual mandate, unwind the programs that we've currently put in place, get back to a more normal kind of monetary policy and regulatory policy, same kind of thing. Try to pull back some of the extra regulations that have been put in place recently. And I think in all these cases, it's pretty straightforward what you do. A person's got to be committed to it and has to have people around him or her that will do these things. And that's what I would urge, is the principles and the people who will deliver on the principles.
On occasion, our listeners will listen to a CNBC pundit or an academic mention the Taylor rule. And lo and behold, this is your rule. You've basically devised a way of figuring out where interest rates should be. Maybe you can explain that a little bit and suggest where interest rates should be. We had Operation Twist under the Kennedy administration in the 60s. We have Operation Twist today, which is essentially a manipulation of interest rates, a changing of where the yield curve is, whereas it would be at a different level. Where should rates be following the John Taylor rule?
The rule is a guideline for central bankers to use to determine where they should set their interest rate. It's very straightforward that the guide says when inflation picks up, then the interest rate should rise by a certain amount. When the economy goes into recession, the interest rate should fall by a certain amount. And the terminology by a certain amount is very important, because the rule says how much the interest rate should change. And that's why I think it's become interesting and useful, quite frankly, to many central bankers around the world when they're making their decisions. Monetary policy is a very tough job. If they have a guideline like this, it helps. With respect to your question about where rates should be now, I think they should be moving into positive territory. I'd say it's there now. By the way, the federal funds rate is between 0 and 0.25, so effectively zero. I think it'd be wiser if the Fed started to move up towards 1% at this point. That's what the Taylor rule would suggest, and that would allow the money markets to function a little better. And I think it would also get us in a situation back to the kind of normal policy that we've had in the past. Whether you call it a Taylor rule or something else, the message of history is clear. When central bankers have been close to this kind of a policy principle, things have worked well. When they deviated, things have not been so good.
The academic discussion today is sort of chain versus unchained CPI, and the argument is actually that we're overstating inflation. It needs to come down a number of basis points. And again, maybe that's just for the academics to sort out. But I look at the Kennedy administration's Operation Twist and in their buying of long-term Treasury bonds and selling of short-term Treasury bills. It's the same thing that we're doing today, and we really don't have a clear reference point in the interest rate market. What are your thoughts on sort of this changing, or I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, but is it fair to say a manipulation of interest rates? We certainly can't afford more than the 2% that we're paying on the national debt. So there's a clear motive to keep it low.
Well, manipulation is the correct word. The Fed has inserted itself into the money market, almost has replaced the money market with itself. It's pumped in so many reserves, and the interest rate is now manipulated simply by deciding how much interest will be paid on bank reserves. It's not a market rate. In the sense that supply and demand is determining the rate. I think the Operation Twist of the 60s, I taught my students for many, many years that Operation Twist in the 60s didn't work. That was the conventional wisdom, by the way. That's what most faculty, most professors taught their students who taught the subject, that Operation Twist didn't work. So it's quite remarkable that we move back to Operation Twist. It's like we just ignored all the things that have been done. And what that shows to me is there's this urge to intervene. There's this urge to do something, even if there's experience that says it doesn't work. And we've got to get away from that. And I hope that, you know, read books, my books, look at history. History is so important for understanding these things, and we won't make these mistakes again.
Again, David, it comes up over and over. Be a student of history. If you don't understand what's happened before, you're not going to understand what happens again. I know you're going to be talking to Michael Pettis, who is a true economic historian.
He's made a life study of market history, of financial economics. And teaching at a university in Beijing is applying that in real time. And we'll certainly enjoy our conversation here with him in a few weeks. But just as a review and a preview, we should look at some of the key themes. Again, if making mistakes can be avoided by understanding the past, then I think understanding globalization and what went into past periods of globalization will certainly help with that.
The whole world has been operating with a debt-driven growth model where exponential growth has been exceeding the exponential accumulation of debt. Everyone has remained happy as long as that's been the case. Now growth is slowing, but the accumulation of debt has not. It's as if the entire globe rises and falls on a sea of easy money. Where are we at in the cycle of credit expansion or credit contraction, in your opinion?
Well, I think of these more broadly as globalization cycles. We've seen, by my count, roughly six of them in the last 200 years, and they all look fairly similar. For some reason, it could be, you know, discoveries of gold, it could be changes in the structure of the banking sector, whatever. You get this increase in underlying liquidity, and with the increase in liquidity, risk appetites go up, the risk premium goes down, money goes into lots of different sectors, and it becomes self-reinforcing because asset prices move up, etc. We've seen this many times before. One of the consequences is that you get increasingly risky debt structures, and you get increasingly debt is used to finance things that can't be repaid. If you look at countries like the United States and Spain before the crisis, a lot of the debt was being used to finance consumption. In addition, and this is the problem in China, a lot of the debt is used to finance assets whose value isn't sufficient to repay the debt ultimately. The history of globalization makes pretty clear that one of the things that always comes out during these periods is globalization, or whatever the contemporary word for it is often proclaimed as being irreversible. It's part of the process that we claim that it's irreversible. And yet in every case, it has not been irreversible. There has been a significant contraction of what had previously been called globalization. So the fact that the World Bank claims that it's irreversible is par for the course. That's part of the process, and it has very little informational content, I would argue. But the way it seems to work, for example, we've been through in the 1990s, in the past decade, a major technological revolution driven by personal computers and the Internet. But the truth is that neither of these were recent innovations. The personal computer was the most important steps were pretty much taken in the 1970s. And the Internet itself arguably was invented in the 1960s. It wasn't really until there was a significant amount of capital available to fund rapid expansion in the Internet infrastructure that we really began to experience the effects of this internet revolution. So I would argue that what really drove the stage of the technological revolution was the availability of financing. And if you look at the past stages of the Industrial Revolution, they always seem to coincide with burgeoning stock markets, massive capital flows to risky countries, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's not a coincidence. It's capital that drives all of that. And just as we have periods of rapid credit expansion, those are always followed when they become excessive, and they usually tend to become excessive. They're always followed by periods of credit contraction. And it is during those periods where we see a lot of the reversals of the supposedly irreversible process. And never in history has there been a major globalization contraction in which the poor countries, the peripheral countries, the developing countries, didn't suffer disproportionately. There have been periods when it seemed it wasn't going to happen, for example, in the 1970s. But it always does happen. And the reason I suspect it happens is because developing countries, peripheral countries, are even more sensitive to changes in liquidity than the rich countries are. So as you get that contraction, the rich countries suffer and the poor countries suffer more, although it may be a delayed suffering. I was never particularly impressed with the survivability of the euro, but what we're seeing recently is a very classic Keynesian type of crisis, and that is that there's a lot of name-calling and blame back and forth. Whoever's fault it is, Germany put into place policies that forced up the savings rate in Germany. And there had to be an automatic correspondent somewhere else. And given monetary union, that somewhere else ended up being within Europe. So it automatically forced down the savings rate in countries like Spain, etc. Now, Spain needs to adjust. And what Keynes would have pointed out is that you can't have adjustment on one side. You must have adjustment on both sides. While we're forcing up the Spanish savings rate, we must simultaneously force down the German savings rate. In other words, if you want Spain to repay Germany, then Spain must run a current account surplus and Germany must run a current account deficit. Otherwise, it's impossible for there to be net capital flows in that direction. So the argument is, and quite a number of people are making this argument, Krugman, Martin Wolf, etc., is that it is meaningless to call for austerity in Spain without calling for a massive reflation in Germany. Because if only Spain adjusts, and when I say Spain, I mean all the peripheral countries, that's the country I was born in, so I usually refer to it. If only Spain adjusts, then the adjustment must take place through a significant rise in unemployment. And then Spain is faced with a choice. It can intervene in trade and force the unemployment into Germany, or it cannot intervene in trade and keep the unemployment at home. And under those conditions, Spain will probably intervene and leave the euro. So there's really where the problem is. If both Spain and Germany make the right kind of adjustments that cause the German surplus to turn into deficit and the Spanish deficit to turn into surplus, then it's at least theoretically possible that we can get out of the European crisis without a significant rise in unemployment. Theoretically, practically, it can be quite difficult. But if Germany doesn't make an equally big adjustment as Spain does, then it is even theoretically impossible for the adjustment to take place without a significant rise in unemployment. And that's exactly what we're seeing in Spain. Unemployment's at 20-something percent. But that had to happen. There was no way around that. So my view is, since there is very little evidence that Germany, rightly or wrongly, is willing to take the necessary steps to reflate the domestic economy, to bring savings rate down, to run into a large enough current account deficit that allows peripheral Europe to survive the crisis, then there's only one other possibility. And that is that Spain, well, there are two possibilities. One is that Spain accepts very high levels of unemployment for many, many years. But I think in a well-functioning democracy, that's impossible, and rightly so. And then that just leaves the other possibility, and that is that Spain devalues the currency, which means leaving the euro. So one way or the other, I'm convinced the euro breaks, and I'm convinced that several countries will have to leave the euro. I really don't, just from a purely arithmetic point of view, I don't see any way around that, you know, absent a major change in attitudes in Germany. If that happens, we're going to have a year of panic and chaos, but it might end for the peripheral countries much more quickly than that, because once they're able to adjust their domestic currency, if they don't completely mismanage the process, we could see fairly decent growth. After all, remember after the Asian crisis, after the Mexican peso crisis in 94, after the Argentine crisis in 2001, there was a very, very difficult year. But after the adjustments were made, all of those countries grew quite quickly. So it's not necessarily bad for the peripheral countries to break and leave the euro. In fact, I would argue the sooner they do it, the better. But the country that will suffer the most, and this is very clear from the historical precedents, is the leading surplus country, which in this case is Germany. If those countries leave the euro, if the peripheral countries leave the euro, Germany will be the one that suffers the most. So it's in their interest to do whatever it takes to reflate the domestic economy. But that's just politically a very hard sell, so I don't expect it to happen. That's a long way of saying, David, that I really don't think the euro survives, and I've never really believed it would.
Well, David, on that happy note, that the euro doesn't survive, I guess we just have to thank the listener for traveling with us this last year and listening to and engaging in the conversation that really carries us around the world. We don't know the future. They don't know the future, but we continue to unpack things and dig as deep as we possibly can at the moment that we're in.
And as Michael has just suggested, I think it echoes what we said in our first DVD last year, dealing with Europe and European perils, that we are not past the crisis, but we are past the point of imminent demise. We may see a reshuffling of the players in the Eurozone. The members of the European Monetary Unit may change, and that may be what constitutes a new and reorganized Europe. But there is a political commitment there, which is very, very strong, and we'll see if the forces of the market and the fiscal integration which needs to take place in order for them to survive is in fact feasible from a political standpoint. We have an election coming up in Germany this next year, which will be very telling how that will look. Will it be a coalition German government? Most likely it will be. How will that be managed into the future? We still, again, are not past the crisis, but just past the point of imminent demise.
Well, and I know, David, in this last year, you analyzed in detail the European issue in The Fuses Lit Part 1, the DVD. The Fuses Lit Part 2 analyzed Asia and China in detail in the Part 2. Now, Part 3 is, like we said last week or a couple of weeks ago, that it is a summary. It puts it all together as a package. Our listeners need to call, if they haven't called, and get a hard copy of those DVDs.
Those are now available. They're back from the printer. Yes, they've made it across the ocean. Not quite 5 weeks on the boat, but they are available. So, yeah, order DVDtoday.com if you want to order it online, or call us at 800-525-9556. And, of course, you can watch it online if you're comfortable with that. Just make sure and send it to as many friends as you can. I think it's very important that people understand the challenges that we face here in the United States over the next several years.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or just give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.